This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start with a story from the January 1986 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is Seymour Llama by Harvey Jacobs. In the clutch of a brutal winter, while Halley's Comet creased a sky the color of blue ice, the town of West Stockton huddled into its skin. The holidays had passed. There were still a few wreaths tacked to doors. The local bar had a string of colored lights dangling in a frosted window, but there was no more sense of celebration. Hope was snowbound. The people were pale. They saw the faces of dead relatives in the exhaust swirls from their cars. Icicles were frozen bones. Lives were cubed, frozen in glossy limbo. Nobody spoke of spring. Bills came in the mail. Brief memories of Christmas pleasure were transformed into numbers printed by a computer. The cold, browsed bodies and houses, looking for cracks and crevices. The invasion of the town was complete. Considering the home of Henry and Ellen Stritz was comfortable. New thermopane windows, a repaired boiler, and a small fireplace kept the temperature constant. One evening, after a nice dinner of chicken, broccoli, baked potatoes, applesauce, and green salad, Henry Stritz got up to walk the dog. He remembered that the dog had died 6 months before. "You got up to walk the dog, didn't you?" said Ellen Stritz. "Don't deny it. I do that myself sometimes. We should get a new dog. I think Seymour needs a new dog." "A new dog. Replace the dog. Dead dog, new dog, that's the way, I suppose." Henry went to look at the frigid night. He wiped a space on the frosted window. A full moon rolled up past the border of evergreens that surrounded his property. It seemed to be boiling. Thin white clouds blew past the moon like puffs of steam. The moon's surface rippled like water in a pot. That afternoon, a sun, the color of a stale wafer, had hung icebound over the town, and now the moon was boiling. Ellen was reading Vanity Fair, looking at a picture of Acapulco. It was a delicious photograph filled with lovely people playing on a beach. In the warm water, swimmers jumped for a rainbow-colored beach ball. Far from the beach, a girl flew strapped to a huge orange kite attached to a white boat that cut the waves. But even that picture did not remind Ellen of spring. It just seemed like another world, far off and unaffordable. Seymour Stritz came down from upstairs, went into the kitchen, came out holding a piece of jellied white bread and a can of Coke. He went over to the television set and turned it on. A black car, alive with computers and digital screens, was talking to its driver about Russian conspirators. "What in hell do you think you're doing?" said Henry. "Knight Rider," Seymour said. "I'm watching Knight Rider. I always watch Knight Rider." "You might have asked before you came in and turned on that set," said Ellen. "That would have been nice." "I always watch Knight Rider." "What about your homework?" "Mostly done. They didn't give much." "They didn't give much. That's fine," Henry said. "Turn that thing down." "It happens to be a very well-done show. You might like it if you gave it a try." "Book. It's a top 10 show." "Top 10, well, just turn it down," Ellen said. "I'm trying to read." The sound from the television, which was now a commercial for cheese, destroyed the Acapulco scene. Everyone scattered from the Golden Beach, and the girl on the kite fell into the water. Ellen closed the magazine and looked over at a huge wedge of cheddar. Henry blocked the sound with his eyes. He focused totally on the moon's globe. He knew Seymour had not done his homework. He knew that in a few weeks they would get a call from some teacher or other telling them about incompletes, themes, compositions, pages of math, but he wasn't in the mood to do battle with his son. He felt drained by the season. His sinuses were dry from hot air pumped up through metal ducts. "Do you want tea or coffee?" "No," Henry said. "Thanks, no." "Tea with milk," Seymour said. "Two spoons." "Too much sugar," Ellen said. "Your face is breaking out again." "That has nothing to do with sugar," Seymour said. The magical car was chasing another car down a concrete highway. When a truck blocked the way, the car went into super turbo and lifted up and over the obstacle. Nothing could stop that car. Seymour felt its fabulous power. It would be marvelous to be able to touch a button and soar. Put them all away. "Sugar doesn't turn to zits. It was on the news. You like the news." "I don't care what was on the news," Ellen said. "I know what I know." "Give him the sugar," Henry said. "Let him be a pimple farm." "Forget the tea," Seymour said. "Just forget it." Ellen went to make the tea. Seymour turned up the set so he could hear the car motor purr. Henry's eyes came down from the giant moon. He thought he saw figures moving through the snow, hunched shapes coming slowly towards the house. He looked hard. There was something out there. Deer, probably. The herd had exploded since hunting was banned in the county. The idea of desperate animals foraging in that cold was depressing. If the dog were alive, it would be barking. The shapes would turn and run. They came closer and closer. "Did you see that?" Seymour said to himself. "My God, these stuntmen are incredible, awesome." Henry wiped more of the window clear. The outer glass of the thermal pane was badly misted, but now he could see that the approaching shapes were human. "Somebody is out there," he said. "What?" Seymour said. "Where?" "Out there in the snow." "That's impossible." "We're going to have visitors." "Who? How should I know? The Brady Bunch? That hasn't been on for 100 years. If it were, you'd watch it. They're coming to the front door." "Who's coming to the front door?" Ellen said. She handed Seymour a cup of tea and put her own on an end table. "I don't recognize any of them. 3 men, I think. It's hard to tell." "If you don't know them, don't open." "I can't leave them standing out in the wind. Maybe their car broke down." "Maybe, maybe not." "Don't open. Tell them you'll call the police to help them. And if they say they want to use the telephone, tell them it's out of order." "Tell who?" Seymour said. "The men out there. If they are men, I can't even see their faces. They're bundled up." "No wonder. Just don't open until you know exactly what you're dealing with." "Let me see," Seymour said. "Where?" "Right out there." "We should have a gun. Everybody else has a gun." "Calm down," Henry said. "This isn't the jungle yet." "Tell me you don't wish you had a gun. Even a .22 rifle. Ellen, maybe you'd better wait upstairs." "Nonsense! This is my home." "Tell them that if they begin to fold, spindle, and mutilate," Seymour said. There was a soft knocking at the door. Ellen thought of going upstairs, but held her ground. Seymour looked over at the television screen. His show was ending. He had missed the final scene. Henry balanced simple decency with a lick of fear. Crime was a reality, and rural crime on the increase. They drove up from the city to ravage. Still, a knock on the door at night in dead winter? You could freeze to death out there. There was another knock, louder, harder. Henry went up to the door, shouted, "Who is it?" The only reply was an insistent tapping. "Who's out there?" "Please open," said a thin voice. "Please open." Seymour shrugged. Ellen nodded no. Henry, who hated severe cold, burning at his lips and lungs, turned the knob. He saw three robed figures waiting. When the light hit them, they actually sparkled. Bits of snow and ice reflected the glow and lit them like store window displays. The tallest, a bearded young man, said, "Thank you. May we come in?" "If you're selling something, we're not in the market right now," Henry said, knowing it was a ridiculous remark. What salesman would be out in a sub-zero night at that hour? "Come in," he said. "Please wipe your boots, the carpet." "Yes, of course," said the tall man, "the carpet." The three visitors began pounding their feet on the small step outside the Stritz's door. A cloud of snow rose from thick fur boots. Henry had never seen boots like that. They could have been the legs of mammoths. Leather thongs laced up their tops and tied into heavy knots. When the tall man stopped slapping his feet against the step, the others stopped too. Henry nodded in response to a stare from the obvious leader. They entered in parade, then stood clumped in the living room. Together, the mass of them reminded Henry of pictures he had seen in a National Geographic of strange habitations made of skins, wood, mud, and rock. Not houses, not tents, but a hodgepodge of random gatherings and steamy leftovers from a hunt. Two were men, the third seemed to be a woman. It was hard to tell under those layers of clothing, fleece jackets, pants made of something like tar paper, fur boots, great odoriferous capes lifted off the backs of oxen with hoods like band shells. "Well," Ellen said, "we were just enjoying a cup of tea. Would you care?" "Nothing, thank you," said the leader. "We realize this is an imposition. Please don't feel obligated to provide any refreshments." "At least take your coats off," Henry said. That had to be said, though Henry had the feeling that taking off those garments would account for at least an hour's work. Seymour watched pools drip from the robes. He knew his mother was trying to contain herself. The carpet was her own skin. Ellen kept quiet. She looked for signs of glinting steel. These intruders probably carried knives. The one Henry took to be a woman began chanting. Her voice rose in a majestic wail that snapped like a whip. The second man, short, round, older man, with a Mongol face, smiled and giggled. The leader examined Seymour as if he were a new life form. "This is the child, then?" "I am sorry," Henry said. "I am Henry Stritz. This is my wife, Ellen. And yes, our only child, Seymour Stritz. I am Chai Fun. This is Lee Dick. And there is Madam Wu. We are all individually most pleased to make your acquaintance. Of the delegation, only I speak English." Madam Wu increased the level of her chanting. She began to wring her gloved hands. Lai Dick bowed and smiled again. Chai Fun held out his hand, and Henry grabbed it and pumped. "This is some kind of gag, right?" Seymour said. "Come on, what is it all about? Bloopers and practical jokes?" "Forgive Seymour," Henry said. "He thinks everything is related to the media." "Is that person all right?" Ellen said. Madam Wu was on her knees, kissing the floor. "Yes, fine. She's excited, though. We have traveled a very long way, and the Holiday Inn was so warm we had to sleep with our windows wide open. The problem there was that the windows don't open." Chai Fun laughed. Lai Dick laughed, too. Henry, Ellen, and Seymour smiled. "They put us in the basement." "So you're staying at the Holiday Inn," Henry said. "Nice enough place for a town this size." "Excellent," said Chai Fun. "Food was something of a problem, though. I had never before seen a shrimp cocktail." Yes, well, Henry said. You want to know why we are here? Is this the time to talk frankly? Have we engaged in sufficient amenities? Sufficient, certainly. We want the child, said Chai Fun. Madam Wu arose from the floor and threw her arms around Seymour. You want what? Said Ellen. Madam Wu pulled at her robe, then at her vest, and there was the sound of fabric ripping. A splendid breast was released, crowned by a rigid nipple. She grabbed Seymour's head and pulled it towards the breast while making a gurgling noise. Seymour's face vanished inside Madame Wu's rent clothing, along with the full, fine breast. She is very emotional, said Chai Fun. Lai Dick shook his head back and forth, then up and down. We all are. This is a fantastic moment, as you must understand. She'll smother him, Ellen said. Yes, mother him. Smother? He needs air. Seymour's arms wriggled, then fell at her side. Seymour saw that his son seemed peaceful enough. Can you expand on your statement about wanting the child? Henry said. Forgive me. I thought our actions were self-evident. I keep forgetting that we do not share a common culture. Sai? Ellen said. Are you all right? Could you clarify your intent? Henry said. As you must know, the Holy Lama, Shi Shu Sha, passed on a month ago, in his 98th year. I must have read it somewhere. Immediately upon the flight of his blessed soul, our monks and wise men looked for signs. It was vital that his chosen heir be found quickly, for religious, practical, and political reasons. I concede that. I gather there is no vice lama to step into the job. Madam Wu fell over on her back, dragging Seymour down with her. She was singing what seemed to be a popular song, making a joyful noise. That's very distracting, Ellen said. We read the stars, the omens, the birds, insect behavior, the flow of clouds, and of course, the ancient books and the configuration of the mountains, which changes with each temblor, seismic shock, or actual quake. The beaks of plumed pigeons were divided by the contractual angles of sun shafts reflecting off our small pyramid. It's not Cheops, but it is ours. And crystals deflected shadows of migratory beasts. Taken together, to make a long story short, an heir was found, your son. Seymour? The heir to Shi Shu Sha? I've got to laugh, Henry said. Please don't laugh, or we will be forced to eviscerate you. Is that a threat? Oh, no, merely an obligation. Now, we bring you some gifts. What gifts? Ellen said. Seymour pulled his head away from the surging breast of Madame Wu. What time is it? He said. I'm missing Dynasty. He rushed to the television set. Keep it low, Henry said. We're talking here. Chai Fun gestured widely to Lai Dick, who produced three sacks and two wooden boxes from inside his robe. He pulled a drawstring on the first sack and spilled a pile of brownish grains onto the coffee table. From the first crop of barley following the Lama's departure. It is, according to our legends, very potent, very lucky. The little parchment you see in the sack contains clever recipes. Thank you, Ellen said. I appreciate that. Lai Dick opened the second sack. It was empty, but he turned the sack, squeezed it, and waved it in the air. There's nothing in there, Henry said. Wrong, said Chai Fun. The Lama's last breath was in there and is now in here. I don't think you fully realize the import. In our country, your home would have increased measurably in value, say 10,000%. We thank you. The thought is the important thing. The third sack held little marbles that proved to be yak droppings. Lydick scattered them around the living room. Those yaks grazed on the mountain of insight and celestial transformation. Their emanations are of urgent interest. What's in the boxes? Henry asked. The boxes? Only jewels. Lydick opened the two boxes. They were filled to brimming with emeralds, sapphires, amethysts, pearls, white and black, rubies, and large diamonds. That's very impressive, Henry said. Just a token of things to come. We really put on the dog at the coronation. Of course you'll come. We have first-class tickets on TWA, and the frequent flyer credits will remain in your name. That's a lot of mileage. And you seriously believe that we will give up our only son, Seymour, for some beads and a few airline tickets? Consider his welfare, Mr. Stritz. Your Seymour will be accepted as our supreme leader. He will live in a palace with a marvelous view of Everest. His every need will be gratified. His every word will be inscribed. The alternative is a liberal arts education and possibly a position with IBM or Apple or digital equipment. And as his parents, Henry, Ellen, you will always be welcomed as the cosmic agents who brought Seymour to us. I'm talking reverence here. I'm talking executive producers, prime time, to use a metaphor. What about reception? Ellen said. One thing you can't offer Seymour is cable. A LSA satellite dish, though, and a VCR. I suppose Seymour would be expected to marry one of your people? Marry? Never. But his choice of women, girls, anything that moves, and his offspring, your grandchildren, will be brought up in a royal fashion. I heard that, Seymour said. He left Madame Wu watching a legs commercial and came to join the conversation. What about music? Is it all the ethnic stuff that lady sings? The best groups come to visit us, Chai Fun said. Our whole country is nothing but acoustics, and the palace is Bang and Olufsen, wired top to bottom. Yes, you'd have to learn a few chants and anthems, but what you hear in the privacy of your Walkman, so to speak, is entirely your affair. You work only 4 times a year during major ceremonies. The rest is California dreaming. My every word is your command, right? Exactly. I could tell you to suck grasshoppers or whatever, and you do it, right? With pleasure and honor. I like it. Maybe when you finish high school, Ellen said. Is all this written down in black and white? Henry said. No, not black and white. In gold, on platinum. Lydick reached into his robe and produced a scroll. It was delicately hand-lettered with swirling letters, drawings of dragons, lions, elephants, dancing girls decorated the sides. I'll have to show that to my lawyer, Henry said. No problem, but we must take Seymour before the moon changes phase. I don't know if I can get hold of my lawyer before the moon changes phase. For this? Ellen said, of course you can. He's my first cousin. What about some kind of crown? Seymour said. Chai Fun waved to Lydick, who hemmed and held out an oval of jade. Seymour put it on and went to look in the mirror. I don't want him spoiled, Ellen said. Remember Elvis? Too much, too soon. He's a bright kid, Henry said. He's got values. They'll see him through. It fits, Seymour said, like a screw top, like I was made for it. Do we have an understanding then? Said Chai Fun. I guess we do. Yes. Why not? Then I must use your phone for a collect call. There will be rejoicing. A collect call, Ellen said. The phone is over there next to the sofa. Chai Fun bowed and picked up the receiver. Since the divestiture of AT&T, one never can be sure, he said. Hello, operator? Yes, I want to call long distance, very long distance. A bit of humor. The area code is 4 digits, 8000, 333-9999, with a 1, as you know, this being your profession. The call is to be collect, person to person, to Cha Keep Mo, C-H-A-K-I-P-M-O. Yes, my name is Chai Fun, C-H-I, Fun, as in fun. Yes, I'm calling from area code 914-999-2122. The phone is in the name of Mr. Henry Stritz. The address is 73 Mapletop Lane. 74 Mapletop Lane, said Seymour. Pardon? Said Chai Fun. 74 Mapletop Lane. Operator, please ignore this call, he said, and hung up. Are you sure this is 74 Mapletop Lane? Roll over, Seymour said. Am I sure? You dare ask? Chai Fun said something to Lai Dick and Madame Wu. He said it again. Tears poured from their eyes. I'm very sorry, said Chai Fun, but we have made a nasty error. You see, we were looking for 73 Mapletop Lane. The Schwartzes? You can't mean it, Ellen said. But I do mean it most emphatically. What would you want with the Schwartzes? Not their kid. Never in a million years, Henry said. Joe Schwartz is a wimp, Seymour said. His head is half the size of mine. The crown would fall down around his genitals. You'd better recheck your pigeon beaks and angles, Henry said. Better do whatever you have to do before you screw up your country's history. An omen is an omen, said Chai Fun. We'll need the hat back, Seymour, and the jewels. You can keep the barley, the breath, and the yak droppings. When you see the Schwartz kid, you'll come running back here, and then we'll talk contract. Mr. Stritz, what can I tell you? It's such a lousy night, we made a wrong turn. How exactly does one get to the house of the Schwartzes? You make a left at the gate, keep walking until you see a mailbox shaped like a kind of hippopotamus. It's cute. You can't miss it. The box says Schwartz on it. Thank you, Mrs. Stritz, Mr. Stritz, Seymour. Up yours, Seymour said. The three visitors departed quickly after gathering up the crown and the two boxes. You didn't have to say up yours, said Ellen. You could have displayed dignity in the circumstances. Come on, Ma, Seymour said. I mean, come off it. They had me excited. God, can you see the Schwartzes all decked out at the coronation with Joe Schwartz standing there with a crown around his behind, Henry said. The Stritzes laughed. I wish the dog were alive to see all this, Henry said. My tea is stone cold, Ellen said, and look at the carpet. Just look at it. If you had kept your mouth shut when he said 73 Mapletop Lane, the operator would never have noticed, Henry said. It was a reflex, Seymour said. I didn't know what I was doing. All those promises of glory, and after what that lady did to me, I nearly drowned. Drowned, not drowned. If you read more, you would know how to speak. Henry Stritz went to the window again. He saw the three figures trudging towards the Schwartz home. There would be no living with the Schwartzes, not after tonight. Count your blessings, Ellen said, coming up beside him. Easy come, easy go. Damn, said Henry. You know the odds against anybody else picking Seymour for that kind of job. Somebody wins every contest, Ellen said. Ellen, you have an earthy wisdom that gets me through. I tend to lose perspective, especially in winter. The Schwartz kid is sickly. He wheezes, Ellen said. I know. We continue with a story from the February 1986 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Lo, How an Oak Ear Blooming by Suzette Hayden Elgin. The day that she caused the miracle, Willow Severty was just plain tired. The women in the audience had been thrashing her a good half hour, and she'd been patiently bearing that, working away one word at a time towards somehow making them understand. But they were angry at her and at the world, and they would not let Willow be. And when words failed her, Willow turned in utter weariness to deeds, one deed to be precise. She stood there, sagging under the lash of their tongues, looking more and more battered and useless every minute. And then she gave herself a sort of shake, the way a tired animal will shake off water, and she raised her two hands before her to ward the other women off. "That's enough," she said, standing there at the front of the room before the rows of chairs beside the speaker's lectern. "That's more than enough. I'm sorry you're so dissatisfied with me, but I can't do any better. And I tell you, you're wrong with that laundry list of yours. I tell you, there have been laws written down since first men could record their wickedness and their pride, and there has always been a way to make those laws no more than chicken scratches. Laws are like wars. Of their making, there is no end, and they're not worth warm spit. I tell you, what we need is a miracle." They would have interrupted her if she'd paused, and she knew that, so she went right on. "A miracle," Willow said again. "Something that money and power and law and science and war cannot do. I've had enough of words. They ignore words anyway. It's time now for signs. Signs and portents. We need a miracle to show them." And she had smiled an exhausted smile and added, "Just a very small miracle will do. It doesn't have to be the levitation of the Pentagon. It will be sufficient if..." Willow looked around her and out over their heads towards the windows at the back of the conference room, and she saw something that would serve her purpose. It would be sufficient for that bare oak tree standing out there naked in the snow to burst all at once into glorious bloom. That would be miracle enough. And she had drawn a deep breath, and it was so. Well, it isn't every day that a big oak flowers in the middle of deep winter or any other time. This flowering was preposterous. It offended all the sensibilities. The experts came in twos and threes. The botanists and the biologists and the linear and nonlinear dynamicists and the horticulturists and even the physicists. When the careful dissection of one of the perfect yellow blooms as big as a teacup proved beyond any question that it was indeed a real flower, a genuine plant form growing and not, as they had first assumed, a creation of plastic or silk or some other man-made substance, there were cautious articles in the scholarly journals about the matter, with photographs of cross-sections of the blossom and its parts under the microscope from a variety of angles and points of view. The botanists, who'd been rather out of it the past decade or so, preened themselves in the center circle of scientific attention and faced the difficult questions. What is it, exactly? An anomaly, they said solemnly. What are those flowers? We don't know, sorry. Well, how could such a thing be? We don't know that either. That is the nature of an anomaly. No one among the experts could explain why, when you took one golden flower from the tree, another formed immediately to take its place. They were soon sorry that they had even mentioned that, because it grew great crowds of people determined to take home an armful of the wonderful blooms for themselves, and it became necessary to set up a permanent security guard around the oak and build a 10-foot-tall steel chain-link fence and a small guardhouse and set a Doberman loping along the perimeter of the secured area. The media were less cautious than the scientists. The National Enquirer had a headline half a page high shrieking, "Roses bloom on winter oak. Bishops declare miracle." Not that the blossoms were roses or any other flower identifiable by man, but it was close enough. It conveyed the sense of the situation. The commercial interests were not cautious either. By the end of the first week, even as the fence was still going up in the muddy, trampled snow, there were hot dog stands and coffee and donut wagons, and there were souvenir vendors selling plastic oaks with yellow plastic flowers in a wide range of sizes, with a small plaque at the base reading, "Replica of the Miracle Oak" in Gothic letters. The churches were at first not only interested but eager. Miracles are not all that common, and a miracle that would go on 24 hours a day, standing up sturdily to every variety of scientific investigation, could not be said to exist anywhere else in the world today. But after the first wave of theologians and evangelists had spoken with Willow Severty, the churches drew back, bruised, into a confused and uneasy silence. The facts appeared to be beyond dispute. There had been 43 witnesses inside the room when Willow called for that oak to bloom in the snow, and another dozen passers-by outside who could not possibly be claimed to have been subject to mob hysteria. The women in the room agreed unanimously that when they had turned to look where Willow was looking, the tree had been there before their eyes in its full blazing glory of golden flowers. And the people outside were in full agreement. One minute, there'd been an oak there, bare and black like any other February oak. And then, all of an instant, the tree had been covered branch after branch with flowers. The people persisted, despite the scientists, in calling the flowers roses. There seemed to be no question but that Willow Severty had called those roses forth. And so the churchmen went to Willow, prepared to be reverent, prepared to find her reverent, and they came away in great confusion. The woman was not a Catholic. She was not a Baptist. She was not even a Christian. The sudden hopes of the Jews, the Muslims, the Druids, the Wiccans, the list was endless, were promptly dashed. Willow Severty accepted no denomination of any known religion. "Do you believe in God?" they asked her, and she smiled at them and went on knitting. When they insisted on an answer, Willow looked up with obvious distaste and said, "Well, would you prefer to think I did it all by myself, gentlemen?" And she grinned in a way that offended them mightily and added, "Or maybe you'd prefer to say, the devil did it." The idea that evil might have power sufficient to set that golden-flowered oak in the snow and maintain it there was simply not tolerable. They writhed under the notion and rejected it for the sake of their sanity. On the other hand, the idea that this unprepossessing female, dumpy and middle-aged and badly dressed, had managed to call forth a miracle without assistance from any organized system of religious doctrine was also intolerable. Of course she had not done it herself. That was silly. But whom had Willow Severty called upon? They demanded to know if she could do it again, and she did laugh at them then. "Gentlemen," she said, "can you do it once?" And when they admitted that they could not, she told them she would wait. "You do it once," she said, "and then we'll see if I can do it twice." They called her impudent and blasphemous, and she laid it out for them. "You can't do it," she said, "not for any amount of money, not with the most powerful weapon in your arsenals, not with the most advanced of your technologies, not with all your mighty faiths combined. Perhaps it's time you reconsidered the value of all those things, gentlemen." And the oak went right on blooming. Seedlings came up around its base and were taken away in armored cars to be planted in greenhouse laboratories where they died at once. Planted outside, set in carefully guarded circles of earth, they died equally promptly. Subjected to grafting, subjected to layering, subjected to cloning, subjected to techniques so advanced that they were military secrets, they died. Every attempt to produce or reproduce them failed. When the time came for acorns, the oak had them in abundance, side by side with the steadfast flowers, but dissection and analysis showed the acorns to be only the ordinary acorns of ordinary oaks, and seedlings forced from those acorns were ordinary seedlings. It might be a century before those seedlings burst into flower, if indeed that was what they were destined someday to do. It wasn't enough to say, "Oh, it's just a new species of oak, which flowers when it grows to a certain age," because it was much worse than that. It violated every natural law. There were plants known to grow with nearly miraculous speed, other and entirely acceptable plants. But there is no plant that bears flowers that never were buds and that never fade or fail. There are no changeless plants. True, if you took a bloom away from the oak, it faded and died like any flower fades and dies. But so long as the flowers were left on the tree, they were immune to all natural processes. High winds did not shake them loose. Searing heat did not make them limp or brown the edges of their petals. The bitterest cold in no way altered their texture or fragrance. A laser would burn one away, as would a torch, but however many you burned, subject the entire time to furious shouts about worshippers demanding that you cease your desecration, another perfect flower would form to replace the burned ones the moment you set the implement of destruction aside. And it was the same with chemicals, with electric currents, with sound waves, with every mechanism the experts could devise. They were afraid to try a nuclear weapon right there in the middle of Madison, Wisconsin, but they had no reason to think the results of such a trial would have been any different. Pressed for comment, Willow Severty said, "Well, loving kindness, what you all call grace, is like that. The more you use it, the more of it there is." And she went back to her struggle to make ends meet, while the scientists applied for ever larger grants to study the oak tree. Some of the women found it strange that the offers made to Willow in the first few days, the book contracts, the movie and television contracts, the proposals for Willow Severty dolls and lunchboxes and bumper stickers and coffee mugs, were all withdrawn before Willow could decide whether any of them were worth signing. Willow didn't find it strange. She had been a little surprised that the media hoopla had been allowed to continue as long as it had, once it became obvious that the oak was no seven-day wonder, but proposed to endure. And as the day approached that would mark the one-year anniversary of the miracle, Willow bought a ticket on the Greyhound bus and took her knitting and withdrew as quietly as she could to a place where nobody would expect her to go. Willow had good sense and endless patience. She went to the slums of Detroit. "What are we going to do?" The questions hovered like a banner in the air over the heads of the assembled members of Project Bad Oak. They would have been pleased if an answer had hovered too, but there was no answer. Everything had been tried, and everything had failed. The woman Willow Severty had brought the oak tree upon the world, and no amount of money or force of technology had proved adequate to duplicate or explain away what she had done. A steady pressure on the channels for dissemination of information had purged them of all mention of the miracle or its worker, but that was not going to be enough. The tree was still there. It still loomed. Anyone who chose to go to Madison, Wisconsin, could see that for himself. The deadly chemicals injected into the tree's roots by stealth in the dead of night had had no effect at all. Sound waves, microwaves, electric shocks, salt, yes, salt, at the suggestion of an agent who knew what salt did to otherwise indestructible purple thistles on his farm, all had failed to bother the tree. It could be described only as flourishing, and the people talked in a variety of languages and social dialects. They talked, but they were all saying the same thing in the end. Huh? You can't do that, can you? Damn straight you can't. People, the mass of people, were snickering. Church attendance had fallen off, as had college enrollments and enlistments in the military. Registrations to vote were down by several percent, as were crimes of violence and hospitalizations. Physicians were reporting a decline in number of patients seen. Retail sales were off just a tad. Lawyers languished for lack of altercations. It was all small numbers, and any one of these taken by itself would not have been worth noticing. But as a general and pervasive trend, it was serious. Gentlemen, said the Secretary of Defense, what we are seeing is the steady growth of a nationwide disrespect for all the institutions of our society. Something must be done. But how the hell did never mind how, hissed the Secretary of Defense. We don't know how, and we don't have time to worry about it. Willow Severty told that gaggle of hysterical feminists that a flowering oak tree was all they needed to make us look pathetic. And she was right. We can't start what she started. We can't do what she did. And we look like impotent asses. We look like wimps. We have to stop it before it gets out of hand. And because what we're dealing with here is not civilized or decent, but is primitive superstition, we cannot allow the first anniversary of Willow Severty's so-called miracle to arrive. We cannot allow that miracle, that symbol, to be created in the public mind. Why so-called miracle, Mr. Secretary? Asked the priest, who sat there as representative of religion. Oh, shut up, Father, said the rest of the men, and he did. It was hard to be strong from a position of total bewilderment. The priest was absolutely certain that God Almighty himself had set that tree aflower and kept it so. But why? Why would he play so monstrous a joke upon his faithful, and for so long? And why had he not ended it in response to the thousands of contemplative religious praying around the clock these past 6 months for him to do so? It was whispered that in the church that an abbess had been heard to say, "Be not afraid, God is not mocked." Oh, yeah? The good father shuddered, and he crossed himself discreetly. Well, what do you propose we do? Half a dozen of the officials present asked the same question as if they had rehearsed, all of them sounding fretful, as befit the powerful made to look foolish by the powerless. We're going to cut the godforsaken, cursed oak tree down, declared the Secretary of Defense, And the priest crossed himself again, too horrified at the godforsaken and the cursed to concern himself about discretion. "That's all?" asked a much decorated general in the silence. "Just cut it down?" "Well, not quite all," admitted the secretary. "A story has been leaked to the press and will be appearing tomorrow. It seems the tree has been discovered to be giving off powerful carcinogens into the air." He glanced at a 3x5 card in his hand and began reeling off the statistics. Leukemias, up 40% in Madison. Cancer of the breast, up 80%. Cancer of the uterus and cervix, up 60%. Cancer of... "We follow you, Mr. Secretary," observed the general. "Who's breaking the story?" "The Washington Post, CBS News, and Reader's Digest, and the National Enquirer." "Dear heaven, they'll call it witchcraft," objected the priest. "So?" the Secretary of Defense sneered. "Let them. We will have stopped it, Father." "Are you sure?" "You betcha, unless someone here can convince me that there's one good reason to do otherwise, and it will take some doing, gentlemen, I warn you. At precisely 0200 tomorrow morning, that tree will be cut to the ground, incinerated to the last centimeter of its smallest twig and root, and the ground where it grew will be sterilized. And after that, my friends, we will pave the entire area over, right out to the perimeter, and put up a Kentucky Fried Chicken place where the tree used to be. Madison, Wisconsin, can use another fried chicken place and another parking lot." He shuffled his 3x5 cards, raised his eyebrows, and waited. And then he said, "Well, does this mean nobody intends to argue?" 6 months earlier, they might have argued. The scientists would have demanded more time to study the phenomenon. The representatives of the humanities might have pleaded for restraint in the face of such magnificence, for awe in the presence of such mystery. The men from business and industry might have hesitated. There is something about an apparently inexhaustible resource that might, under adequate resources and controls, might repay further investigation, and so on. But now they were wiser men, even the men of the cloth, and they knew a menace when they saw one a-blooming. They offered no objections. At 2 o'clock in the morning, the surrounding population, already evacuated by grim law enforcement and emergency personnel announcements, announcements about a life-threatening emergency that could not be explained for lack of time, it began. A crew of men who were more uncomfortable than they would have been willing to admit cut and burned the oak flat to the ground. A bulldozer made certain no least thread of a root was left, turning the ground over not once but three times at the direct order of the Department of Defense, although the source of the order for public information was the EPA. A sterilizing substance was spread over the barren earth, and a concrete mixer brought in and parked at the ready on the site. When dawn broke over Madison, Wisconsin, the morning news carried reports of a terrible danger safely eliminated by our tax dollars at work, along with a picture of the blasted earth where the Doberman now ran superfluously inside the fence, with nothing left to guard but a bulldozer and a cement mixer. There was outrage for a few days, but as people read the story in the Reader's Digest and listened to CBS News, the word spread and the protests died quickly from the pulpits. People were gravely reminded that the Holy Bible not only admits that witches are real, but declares that they must not be allowed to live. In Detroit, Willow Severty smiled to herself when the agents turned up and began following her around. She understood that it would be contrary to the national interest for her to become a martyr during this brief period before the whole foolish episode faded from the public consciousness. The feminists muttered, "All the same, she did it, and none of them could do it." But nobody pays any attention to feminists except other feminists, and the feminists themselves had never cared much for Willow Severty. They muttered a while, but in the backs of their minds, they were thinking again of legislation. So it was that not a single camera crew was present on the anniversary of the miracle of the oak tree in Madison, Wisconsin. Only the construction crew putting up the Kentucky Fried Chicken place and one loose security guard and the bored Doberman were there when the ground began to heave and quake under the concrete. They clung to the framework of the Kentucky Fried Chicken place as best they could and got out of the way as best they could. It was a darn shame that Willow Severty could not have been there to see the spectacle. The great oak rose straight up into the air where the chicken frying machines were to have been, its sturdy roots shoving the spanking new parking lot surface aside and piling it up along the fissures. The tree was heavily laden with yellow flowers that looked very much like roses, and the crisp February air was filled with their fragrance. The snow was a nice touch, falling softly to cover up the broken concrete and lightly lace the edges of the blossom's petals with white. It was a regular picture postcard, doing Madison proud. It was positively a symbol there in the center of town. Peace on earth, it said. Goodwill to men. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.